definitely one of the good fairies. In fact, she was the second in command to Mab, the queen of air and darkness, and she was a bloodthirsty, dangerous being who divided her enemies into two categories, those who were dead and those in which she had not yet taken pleasure. I hadn't known that she knew about Harry and Thomas, but it didn't shock me. Leah was a murderous, cruel creature, but as far as I knew, she had never lied to me. Technically. "Come," said the Lenanshi. She turned and walked briskly toward the far end of the alley, gathering a seaming and a veil around her as she went, to hide herself from notice. I glanced back toward the building where Thomas was being held, ground my teeth, and followed her, merging my veil with hers as we left. We walked Chicago's streets unseen by thousands of eyes. The people we passed all took a few extra steps to avoid us without really thinking about it. It's important to lay out an avoidance suggestion like that when you're in a crowd. Being unseen is kind of pointless if dozens of people keep bumping into you. "Tell me, child," Leah said, shifting abruptly out of her archaic dialect. She did that sometimes when we were alone. "What do you know of Svart elves?" "A little," I said. "They're from Northern Europe originally. They're small and they live underground. They're the best magical craftsmen on Earth. Harry bought things from them whenever he could afford it, but they weren't cheap." "How dry," the fairy sorceress said. "You sound like a book, child. Books frequently bear little resemblance to life." Her intense green eyes glittered as she turned to watch a young woman with an infant walk by us. "What do you know of them?" "They're dangerous," I said quietly. "Very dangerous. The old Norse gods used to go to them for weapons and armor, and they didn't try to fight them. Harry said he was glad he never had to fight a Svart elf. They're also honorable. They signed the Unseelie Accords, and they uphold them. They have a reputation for being savage about protecting their own. They aren't human, they aren't kind, and only a fool crosses them."
"Better," the Lenanshi said. Then she added, in an offhand tone, "Fool."
I glanced back toward the building I'd found. "That's their property?"
"Their fortress," Leah replied. "The center of their mortal affairs, here at the Great Crossroads. What else do you recall of them?"
I shook my head. One of the Norse goddesses got jacked for her jewelry.
"Freya," Leah said.
"And the thief?"
"Loki."
"Yeah, him. He pawned it with the Svart elves or something, and there was a big to-do about getting it back."
"One wonders how it is possible to be so vague and so accurate at the same time," Leah said.
I smirked. Leah frowned at me.
"You knew the story perfectly well. You were tweaking my nose, I believe, is the saying."
"I had a good teacher in snark class," I said. "Freya went to get her necklace back, and the Svart elves were willing to do it, but only if she agreed to kiss each and every one of them."
Leah threw her head back and laughed. "Child," she said, a wicked edge to her voice. "Remember that many of the old tales were translated and transcribed by rather prudish scholars."
"What do you mean?" I asked.
"That the Svart elves most certainly did not agree to give up one of the most valuable jewels in the universe for a society-wide trip to first base."
I blinked a couple of times and felt my cheeks heat up.
"You mean she had to..."
"Precisely."
"All of them?"
"Indeed." "Wow," I said. "I like to accessorize as much as the next girl, but that's over the line. Way over. I mean, you can't even see the line from there."
"Perhaps," Leah said. "I suppose it depends upon how badly one needs to recover something from the Svart elves."
You're saying I need to pull a train to get Thomas out of there? 'Cause that just isn't going to happen."
Leah showed her teeth in another smile. "Morality is amusing."
"Would you do it?"
Leah looked offended. "For the sake of another? Certainly not. Have you any idea of the obligation that would incur?"
Not exactly."
"This is not my choice to make. You must ask yourself this question. Is your untroubled conscience more valuable to you than the vampire's life?"
"No, but there's got to be another way."
Leah seemed to consider that for a moment. Svart elves love beauty. They covet it the way a dragon lusts for gold. You are young, lovely, and, I believe the phrase is, smoking hot. The exchange of your favors for the vampire, a straightforward transaction, is almost certain to succeed, assuming he still lives. We'll call that one Plan B, I said, or maybe Plan X, or Plan Triple X. Why not just break in and burgle him out? Child, the Lenanshi chided me. The Svart elves are quite skilled in the art, and this is one of their strongholds. I could not attempt such a thing and leave with my life. Leah tilted her head to one side and gave me one of those alien looks that made my skin crawl. Do you wish to recover Thomas or not? I wish to explore my options, I said. The fairy sorceress shrugged. Then I advise you to do so as rapidly as possible. If he yet lives, Thomas Wraith might count the remainder of his life in hours. I opened the door to Waldo's apartment, shut and locked it behind me, and said, "Found him." As I turned toward the room, someone slapped me hard across the face. This wasn't a, "Hey, wake up," kind of slap. It was an open-handed blow, one that would have really hurt if it was delivered with a closed fist. I staggered to one side, stunned. Waldo's girlfriend, Andy, folded her arms and stared at me through narrowed eyes for a moment. She was a girl of medium height, but she was a werewolf, and she was built like a pin-up model who was thinking about going into professional wrestling. "Hi, Molly," she said. "Hi," I said. "And, ow!" She held up a pink plastic razor. "Let's have a talk about boundaries." Something ugly, way down deep inside me somewhere, unsheathed its claws and tensed up. That was the part of me that wanted to catch up to listen and do things involving railroad spikes and drains in the floor. Everyone has that inside them somewhere. It takes fairly horrible things to awaken that kind of savagery, but it's in all of us. It's the part of us that causes senseless atrocities, that makes war hell. No one wants to talk about it or think about it, but I couldn't afford that kind of willing ignorance. I hadn't always been this way, but after a year fighting the Fomor and the dark underside of Chicago's supernatural scene, I was somebody else. That part of me was awake and active and constantly pushing my emotions into conflict with my rationality. I told that part of me to shut up and sit its ass down. "Okay," I said, "but later. I'm kind of busy." I started to brush past her into the room, but she stopped me short by placing a hand against my sternum and shoving me back against the door. It didn't look like she was trying, but I hit the wood firmly. "Now's good," she said. In my imagination, I clenched my fists and counted to five in an enraged scream. I was sure Harry had never had to deal with this kind of nonsense. I didn't have time to lose, but I didn't want to start something violent with Andy either. I'd catch all kinds of hell if I threw down. I allowed myself the pleasure of gritting my teeth, took a deep breath, and nodded. "Okay. What's on your mind, Andy?" I didn't add the words, "you bitch," but I thought them really loud. I should probably be a nicer person. "This is not your apartment," Andy said. "You don't get to roll in and out of here whenever you damned well please, no matter the hour, no matter what's going on. Have you even stopped to think about what you're doing to Butters?" "I'm not doing anything to Butters," I said. "I'm just borrowing the shower." Andy's voice sharpened. "You came here today covered in blood. I don't know what happened, but you know what? I don't care. All I care about is what kind of trouble you might draw down onto other people." "There was no trouble," I said. "Look, I'll buy you a new razor." "This isn't about property or money." "Christ," Andy said. "This is about respect. Butters is there for you whenever you need help, and you barely do so much as thank him for it. What if you've been followed here? Do you have any idea how much trouble he could get into for helping you out?" "I wasn't followed," I said. "Today," Andy said. "But what about next time? You have power. You can fight. I don't have what you do, but even I can fight. Butters can't. Whose shower are you going to use if it's his blood all over you?"
I folded my arms and looked carefully away from Andy. In some part of my brain, I knew that she had a point, but that reasoning was coming in a distant second to my sudden urge to slap her. "Look, Molly," she said, her voice becoming gentler. "I know things haven't been easy for you lately, ever since Harry died. When his ghost showed up, I know it wasn't fun." I just looked at her without speaking. Not easy or fun. That was one way to describe it. "There's something I think you need to hear."
"What's that?"
Andy leaned forward slightly and sharpened her words. "Get over it." The apartment was very quiet for a moment, and the inside of me wasn't. That ugly part of me started getting louder and louder. I closed my eyes. "People die, Molly," Andy continued. "They leave, and life goes on. Harry may have been the first friend you lost, but he won't be the last. I get that you're hurting. I get that you're trying to step into some really big shoes, but that doesn't give you the right to abuse people's better natures. A lot of people are hurting lately if you didn't notice." If I didn't notice, God, I would absolutely kill to be able not to notice people's pain, not to live it beside them, not to sense its echoes hours or days later. The ugly part of me, the black part of my heart, wanted to open a psychic channel to Andy and show her the kind of thing I went through on a regular basis. Let her see how she would like my life. And we'd see if she was so righteous afterward. It would be wrong, but I took a slow breath. No. Harry told me once that you can always tell when you're about to rationalize your way to a bad decision. It's when you start using phrases such as, "it would be wrong, but..." His advice was to leave the conjunction out of the sentence. It would be wrong. Period. So I didn't do anything rash. I didn't let the rising tumult inside me come out. I spoke softly. "What is it you'd like me to do exactly?" Andy huffed out a little breath and waved a vague hand.
"Just get your head out of your ass, girl. I'm not being unreasonable here, given that my boyfriend gave you a key to his freaking apartment."
I blinked once at that. Wow, I hadn't even really considered that aspect of what Butters had done. Romance and romantic conflict hadn't exactly been high on my list lately. Andy had nothing to worry about on that front, but I guess she didn't have way too much awareness of people's emotions to tip her off to that fact. Now I could put a name to some of the worry in her. She wasn't jealous exactly, but she was certainly aware of the fact that I was a young woman a lot of men found attractive and that Waldo was a man. And she loved him. I could feel that too.
"Think about him," Andy said quietly. "Please. Just try to take care of him the way he takes care of you. Call ahead. If you just walked in covered with blood next Saturday night, he would have had something very awkward to explain to his parents."
I most likely would have sensed the unfamiliar presences inside the apartment before I got close enough to touch the door, but there was no point in telling Andy that. It wasn't her fault that she didn't really understand the kind of life I lived. Certainly she didn't deserve to die for it, no matter what the opinion of my inner Sith. I had to make my choices with my head. My heart was too broken to be trusted.
"I'll try," I said.
"Okay," Andy said. For a second, the fingers of my right hand quivered, and I found the ugly part of me about to hurl power at the other woman, blind her, deafen her, drown her in vertigo. Leah had shown me how. But I reeled the urge to attack back under control.
"Andy," I said instead.
"Yes."
"Don't hit me again, unless you intend to kill me."
I didn't mean it as a threat exactly. It was just that I tended to react with my instincts when things started getting violent. The psychic turbulence of that kind of conflict didn't make me fall over screaming in pain anymore, but it did make it really hard to think clearly over the furious roaring of ugly me. If Andy hit me like that again, well, I wasn't completely sure how I would react. I'm not Mad Hatter insane, I'm pretty sure, but studying survival under someone like Auntie Leah leaves you ready to protect yourself, not to play well with others. Threat or not, Andy had seen her share of conflict, and she didn't back down.
If I don't think you need a good smack in the face, I won't give you one.
Waldo and Justine had gone out to pick up some dinner and got back about 10 minutes later. We all sat down to eat while I reported on the situation.
Svartalfheim, Justine breathed. That's not good.
Those are the Norse guys, right?
Butters asked. I filled them in between bites of orange chicken, relaying what I had learned from the Lenanshi. There was a little silence after I did.
So, Andy said after a moment, the plan is to boink him free?
I gave her a look. I'm just asking, Andy said in a mild voice.
They'd never sell,
Justine said, her voice low, tight.
Not tonight.
I eyed her. Why not?
They concluded an alliance today, she said. There's a celebration tonight. Lara was invited.
What alliance? I asked.
A non-aggression pact, Justine said. With the Fomor.
I felt my eyes widen. The Fomor situation just kept getting worse and worse. Chicago was far from the most preyed-upon city in the world, and they had still made the streets a nightmare for those of even modest magical talent. I didn't have access to the kind of information I had when I was working with Harry and the White Council, but I'd heard things through the Paranet and other sources. The Fomor were kind of an all-star team of bad guys, the survivors and outcasts and villains of a dozen different pantheons that had gone down a long time ago. They'd banded together under the banner of a group of beings known as the Fomor, and had been laying quiet for a long time, for thousands of years, in fact. Now they were on the move, and even powerful interests like Svartalfheim, the nation of the Svartalves, were getting out of the way. Wow, I was so not wizard enough to deal with this.
Lara must have sent Thomas in for something, Justine said. To steal information, to disrupt the alliance somehow, something. Trespassing would be bad enough. If he was captured spying on them,
they'll have a demonstration, I said quietly. They'll make an example.
Couldn't the White Court get him out? Waldo asked.
If the White Court seeks the return of one of their own, it would be like admitting they sent an agent in to screw around with Svartalfheim, I said. Lara can't do that without serious repercussions. She'll deny that Thomas's intrusion had anything to do with her. Justine rose and paced the room, her body tight.
We have to go. We have to do something. I'll pay the price. I'll pay it 10 times. We have to do something.
I took a few more bites of orange chicken, frowning and thinking.
Molly, Justine said.
I looked at the chicken. I liked the way the orange sauce contrasted with the deep green of the broccoli and the soft white contours of the rice. The three colors made a pleasant complement. It was beautiful, really.
They covet beauty like a dragon covets gold, I murmured.
Butters seemed to clue into the fact that I was on to something. He leaned back in his chair and ate steadily from a box of noodles, his chopsticks precise. He didn't need to look to use them. Andy picked up on it a second later and tilted her head to one side.
Molly? She asked.
They're having a party tonight, I said. Right, Justine?
Yes.
Andy nodded impatiently. What are we going to do?
We, I said, are going shopping.
I'm kind of a tomboy. Not because I don't like being a girl or anything, because for the most part I think it's pretty sweet, but I like the outdoors and physical activities and learning stuff and reading things and building things. I've never really gotten very deep into the girly parts of being a girl. Andy was a little bit better at it than me. The fact that her mother hadn't brought her up the way mine had probably accounted for it. In my house, makeup was for going to church and for women with easy morals. I know. The mind boggles at the contradiction. I had issues way before I got involved with magic, believe me. I wasn't sure how to accomplish what we needed in time to get to the party, but once I explained what we needed, I found out that when it came to being a girly girl,
Justine had her shit wired tight. Within minutes, a town car picked us up and whisked us away to a private salon in the Loop, where Justine produced a completely unmarked, plain white credit card. About 20 staff members, wardrobe advisors, hairdressers, makeup artists, tailors, and accessory technicians leapt into action and got us kitted out for the mission in a little more than an hour. I couldn't really get away from the mirror this time. I tried to look at the young woman in it objectively, as if she were someone else, and not the one who had helped kill the man she loved, and who had then failed him again by being unable to prevent even his ghost from being destroyed in its determination to protect others. That bitch deserved to be run over by a train or something. The girl in the mirror was tall and had naturally blonde hair that had been rapidly swirled up off of her neck and suspended with gleaming black chopsticks. She looked lean, probably too much so, but had a little too much muscle tone to be a meth addict. The little black dress she wore would turn heads. She looked a little tired, even with the expertly applied makeup. She was pretty, if you didn't know her, and if you didn't look too hard at what was going on in her blue eyes. A white stretch limo pulled up to get us, and I managed to dodder out to it without falling all over myself. "Oh my God," Andy said when we got in. The redhead stuck her feet out and wiggled them. "I love these shoes. If I have to wolf out and eat somebody's face, I am going to cry to leave these behind." Justine smiled at her, but then looked out the window, her lovely face distant, worried. "They're just shoes." "Shoes that make my legs and my butt look awesome," Andy said. "Shoes that hurt," I said. My wounded leg might have healed up, but moving around in these spiky torture devices was a new motion, and a steady ache was spreading up through my leg toward my hip. The last thing I needed was for my leg to cramp up and drop me to the ground, the way it had kept doing when I first started walking on it again. Any shoes with heels that high should come with their own safety net, or a parachute. We'd gone with similar outfits. Stylish little black dresses, black chokers, and black pumps that proclaimed us hopeful that we wouldn't spend much time on our feet. Each of us had a little Italian leather clutch, too. I put most of my magical gear in mine. All of us had our hair up in styles that varied only slightly. There were forged Renaissance paintings that had not had as much artist's attention as our faces. "It just takes practice wearing them," Justine said. "Are you sure this is going to work?" "Of course it is," I said calmly. "You've been to clubs, Justine. The three of us together would skip the line to any place in town. We're a matched set of hotness." "Like the Robert Palmer girls," Andy said dryly. "I was going to go with Charlie's Angels," I said. "Oh, speaking of..." I opened the clutch and drew out a quartz crystal the size of my thumb. "Bosley, can you hear me?" A second later, the crystal vibrated in my fingers, and we heard Waldo's faint voice coming from it.
"Loud and clear, Angels. You think these will work once you get inside?"
"It depends on how paranoid they are," I said. "If they're paranoid, they'll have defenses in place to cut off any magical communications. If they're murderously paranoid, they'll have defenses in place that let us talk so that they can listen in, and then they'll kill us."
"Fun," Butters said. "Okay, I've got the Paranet chat room up. For what it's worth, the hive mind is online."
"What have you found out?" Andy asked.
"They'll look human," Waldo replied. "Their real forms are... well, there's some discussion, but the basic consensus is that they look like aliens."
"Ripley or Roswell?" I asked.
"Roswell, more or less. They can wear flesh forms, though, kind of like the Red Court vampires did. So be aware that they'll be disguised."
"Got it," I said. "Anything else?"
"Not much," he said. "There's just too much lore floating around to pick out anything for sure. They might be allergic to salt. They might be supernaturally OCD and flip out if you wear your clothes inside out. They might turn to stone in sunlight."
I growled. It was worth a shot. "Okay, keep the discussion going, and I'll get back to you if I can."
"Got it," he said. "Marcy just got here. I'll bring the laptop with me, and we'll be waiting for you on the east side of the building when you're ready to go." "How do you look, Andy-licious?"
"Fabulous," Andy said confidently.
The hemlines on these dresses stop about an inch short of slutty nymphomaniac.
"Someone take a picture," he said cheerfully, but I could hear the worry in his voice. "I'll see you soon."
"Don't take any chances," I said. "See you soon." I put the crystal away and tried to ignore the butterflies in my stomach.
"This isn't going to work,"
Justine murmured.
"It's going to work," I told her, keeping my tone confident. "We'll breeze right in. The rack will be with us."
Justine glanced at me with an arched eyebrow.
"The rack?"
"The rack is more than just boobs, Justine," I told her soberly. "It's an energy field created by all living boobs. It surrounds us, penetrates us, and binds the galaxy together."
Andy started giggling.
"You're insane." "But functionally so," I said, and adjusted myself to round out a little better.
"Just let go your conscious self and act on instinct." Justine stared blankly at me for a second. Then her face lightened, and she let out a little laugh.
"The rack will be with us?"
I couldn't stop myself from cracking a smile.
"Always."
The limo joined a line of similar vehicles, dropping people off at the entrance to the Svart Alf stronghold. A valet opened our door, and I swung my legs out and tried to leave the car without flashing everyone in sight. Andy and Justine followed me out, and I started walking confidently toward the entrance with the other two flanking me. Our heels clicked in near unison, and I suddenly felt every eye in sight swivel toward us. A cloud of thought and emotion rolled out in response to our presence. Pleasure, mostly, along with a mixed slurry of desire, outright lust, jealousy, anxiety, and surprise. It hurt to feel all of that scraping against the inside of my head, but it was necessary. I didn't sense any outright hostility or imminent violence, and the instant of warning I might get between sensing an attacker's intention and the moment of attack might save our lives. A security guard at the door watched us intently as we approached, and I could feel the uncomplicated sexual attraction churning through him. He kept it off his face and out of his voice and body, though.
"Good evening, ladies," he said. "May I see your invitations?"
I arched an eyebrow at him, gave him what I hoped was a seductive smile, and tried to arch my back a little more. Deploying the rack had worked before.
"You don't need to see our invitation."
He said.
"Miss, I kind of do."
Andy stepped up beside me and gave him a sex kitten smile that made me hate her a little, just for a second.
"No, you don't."
He said.
"Yeah, still do."
Justine stepped up on my other side. She looked more sweet than sexy, but only barely.
"I'm sure it was just an oversight, sir. Couldn't you ask your supervisor if we might come to the reception?"
He stared at us for a long moment, clearly hesitant. Then, one hand slowly went to the radio at his side, and he lifted it to his mouth. A moment later, a slight, small man in a silk suit appeared from inside the building. He took a long look at us. The interest I'd felt from the guard was fairly normal. It had just been a spark, the instinct-level response of any male to a desirable female. What came off of the new guy was... it was more like a road flare. It burned 1,000 times hotter and brighter, and it kept on burning. I'd sensed lust and desire in others before. This went so much deeper and wider than mere lust that I didn't think there was a word for it. It was a vast and inhuman yearning, blended with a fierce and jealous love, and seasoned with sexual attraction and desire. It was like standing near a tiny sun, and I suddenly understood exactly what Auntie Leah had been trying to tell me. Fire is hot, water is wet, and Svart Elves are suckers for pretty girls. They could no more change their nature than they could the course of the stars.
"Ladies,"
the new guy said, smiling at us. It was a charming smile, but there was something distant and disquieting in his face all the same.
"Please wait just a moment for me to alert my other staff. We would be honored if you would join us."
He turned and went inside. Justine gave me a sidelong look.
The rack can have a powerful influence over the weak-minded, I said.
I'd feel better if he hadn't left on a Darth Vader line, Andy breathed. He smelled odd. Was he?
Yeah, I whispered back. One of them.
The man in the silk suit reappeared, still smiling, and opened the door for us.
Ladies, he said, I am Mr. Etchery. Please, come inside.
I had never in my life seen a place more opulent than the inside of the Svart Alv stronghold. Not in magazines, not in the movies, not even on cribs. There were tons of granite and marble. There were sections of wall that had been inlaid with precious and semi-precious stones. Lighting fixtures were crafted of what looked like solid gold, and the light switches looked like they'd been carved from fine ivory. Security guards were stationed every 20 or 30 feet, standing at rigid attention like those guys outside Buckingham Palace, only without the big hats. Light came from everywhere and from nowhere, making all shadows thin and wispy things without becoming too bright for the eyes. Music drifted on the air, some old classical thing that was all strings and no drum beat. Etchery led us down a couple of hallways to a vast cathedral of a ballroom. It was absolutely palatial in there. In fact, I was pretty sure that the room shouldn't have fit in the building we'd just entered, and it was filled with expensive-looking people in expensive-looking clothing. We paused in the entry while Etchery stopped to speak to yet another security guy. I took the moment it offered to sweep my gaze over the room. The place wasn't close to full, but there were a lot of people there. I recognized a couple of celebrities, people you'd know if I told you their names. There were a number of the Shi in attendance, their usual awe-inspiring physical perfection muted to mere exotic beauty. I spotted gentleman Johnny Marcone, the head of Chicago's outfit, in attendance, with his gorilla, Hendrix, and his personal attack witch, Guard, floating around near him. There were any number of people who I was sure weren't people. I could sense the blurring of perception in the air around them, as if they were cut off from me by a thin curtain of falling water. But I didn't see Thomas.
Molly, Justine whispered, barely audible. Is he?
The tracking spell I'd focused on my lips was still functioning, a faint tingle telling me that Thomas was nearby, deeper into the interior of the building.
He's alive, I said. He's here.
Justine shuddered and took a deep breath. She blinked slowly once, her face showing nothing as she did. I felt the surge of simultaneous relief and terror in her presence, though, a sudden blast of emotion that cried out for her to scream or fight or burst into tears. She did none of that, and I turned my eyes away from her in order to give her the illusion that I hadn't noticed her near meltdown. In the center of the ballroom, there was a small, raised platform of stone with a few stairs leading up onto it. Upon the platform was a podium of the same material. Resting on the podium was a thick folio of papers and a neat row of fountain pens. There was something solemn and ceremonial about the way it was set up. Justine was looking at it, too.
That must be it.
The treaty?
She nodded.
The Svart Alves are very methodical about business. They'll conclude the treaty precisely at midnight. They always do.
Andy tapped a finger thoughtfully on her hip.
What if something happened to their treaty first? I mean, if someone spilled a bunch of wine on it or something. That would be attention-getting, I bet. Maybe give a couple of us a chance to sneak farther in.
I shook my head. No, we're guests here. Do you understand?
Not really.
The Svart Alves are old school. I said, really old school. If we break the peace when they've invited us into their territory, we're violating our guest right and offering them disrespect as our hosts, right out in the open, in front of the entire supernatural community. They'll react badly.
Andy frowned and said, then what's our next move?
Why do people keep asking me that? Is this what all wizard types go through?
I'd probably asked Harry that question 100 times, but I never realized how hard it was to hear it coming toward you. But Harry always knew what to do next. All I could do was improvise desperately and hope for the best.
Justine, I said, do you know any of the players here?
As Lara Wraith's personal assistant, Justine came in contact with a lot of people and not quite people. Lara had so many fingers in so many pies that I could barely make a joke about it, and Justine saw, heard, and thought a lot more than anyone gave her credit for. The white-haired girl scanned the room, her dark eyes flicking from face to face.
Several.
All right, I want you to circulate and see what you can find out, I said. Keep an eye out. If you see them sending the brute squad after us, get on the crystal and warn us.
Okay,
Justine whispered.
Careful.
Etri returned and smiled again, though his eyes remained oddly, unsettlingly without expression. He flicked one hand, and a man in a tux floated over to us with a tray of drinks. We helped ourselves, and Etri did too. He lifted his glass to us and said,
"Ladies, be welcome. To beauty."
We echoed him, and we all sipped. I barely let my lips touch the liquid. It was champagne, really good stuff. It fizzed, and I could barely taste the alcohol. I wasn't worried about poison. Etri had quite diffidently allowed us to choose our glasses before taking one of his own. I was actually more worried about the fact that I'd stopped to consider potential poisoning and to watch Etri's actions carefully as he served us. Is it paranoid to worry about things like that? It seemed reasonable to me at the time.
Man, maybe I'm more messed up than I thought I was.
"Please enjoy the reception," Etri said. "I'm afraid I must insist on a dance with each of you lovely young ladies when time and duty allow. Who shall be first?"
Justine gave him a rack-infused smile and lifted her hand. If you twisted my arm, I'd tell you that Justine was definitely the prettiest girl in our little trio, and Etri evidently agreed. His eyes turned warm for an instant before he took Justine's hand and led her out onto the dance floor. They vanished into the moving crowd.
"I couldn't do this ballroom stuff anyway," Andy said. "Not nearly enough booty bouncing. Next move time?"
"Next move time," I said. "Come on." I turned to follow the tingle in my lips, and the two of us made our way to the back side of the ballroom, where doors led deeper into the facility. There were no guards on the doors, but as we got closer, Andy's steps started to slow. She glanced over to one side, where there was a refreshments table, and I saw her begin to turn toward it. I caught her arm and said,
"Hold it. Where are you going?"
She said, frowning. "Over there?" I extended my senses and felt the subtle weaving of magic in the air around the doorway, cobweb fine. It was a kind of veil, designed to direct the attention of anyone approaching it away from the doorway and toward anything else in the room. It made the refreshment table look yummier. If Andy had spotted a guy, he would have looked a lot cuter than he actually was. I'd been having a powerful fairy sorceress throwing veils and glamours at me for almost a year, building up my mental defenses, and a few months ago, I'd gone 12 rounds in the psychic boxing ring with a heavyweight champion necromancer. I hadn't even noticed the gentle, magical weaving hitting my mental shields.
"It's an enchantment," I told her. "Don't let it sway you."
"What?" she asked.
"I don't feel anything. I'm just hungry."
"You wouldn't feel it," I said. "That's how it works. Take my hand and close your eyes. Trust me."
"If I had a nickel for every time a bad evening started with a line like that," she muttered,
but she put her hand in mine and closed her eyes. I walked her toward the doorway and felt her growing tenser as we went, but then we passed through it and she let out her breath explosively, blinking her eyes open.
"Wow, that felt like nothing at all."
"It's how you recognize quality enchantment," I said. "If you don't know it's got you, you can't fight it off." The hallway we stood in looked much like any in any office building. I tried the nearest door and found it locked. So were the next couple, but the last was an empty conference room, and I slipped inside. I fumbled the crystal out of my little clutch and said, "Bosley, can you hear me?"
"Loud and clear, angels," came Waldo's voice.
Neither of us used real names. The crystals were probably secure, but a year with Leah's nasty trickery as a daily feature of life had taught me not to make many assumptions.
"Were you able to come up with those floor plans?"
About 90 seconds ago, the building's owners filed everything with the city in triplicate, including electronic copies, which I am now looking at, courtesy of the Hive Mind.
Advantage nerds, I said. Tell them they did good, boss.
Will do, Waldo said. These people you're visiting are thorough angels. Be careful.
When am I not careful? I said. Andy had taken up a guard position against the wall next to the door where she could grab anyone who opened it.
Seriously?
I couldn't help but smile a little. I think our lost lamb is in the wing of the building to the west of the reception hall. What's there?
Offices, it looks like. Second floor, more offices. Third floor, more off- Hello there.
What did you find?
A vault, Waldo said. Reinforced steel. Huge.
Ha, I said. A reinforced steel vault? $20 says it's a dungeon. We start there.
Whatever it is, it's in the basement. There should be a stairway leading down to it at the end of the hallway leading out of the reception hall.
Bingo, I said.
Stay tuned, Bosley. Will do. Your chariot awaits.
I put the crystal away and began putting on my rings. I got them all together, then began to pick up my wands, and realized that I couldn't carry them in each hand while also carrying the little clutch.
I knew I should have gone for a messenger bag, I muttered.
With that dress? Andy asked. Are you kidding?
True. I took the crystal out and tucked it into my décolletage, palmed one of the little wands in each hand, and nodded to Andy. If it's a vault or a dungeon, there will be guards. I'm going to make it hard for them to see us, but we might have to move fast.
Andy looked down at her shoes and sighed mournfully. Then she stepped out of them and peeled the little black dress off. She hadn't been wearing anything underneath. She closed her eyes for a second, and then her form just seemed to blur and melt. Werewolves don't do dramatic, painful transformations, except right at first, I've been told. This looked as natural as a living being turning in a circle and sitting down. One moment Andy was there, and the next there was a great, russet-furred wolf sitting where she'd been. It was highly cool magic. I was going to have to figure out how that was done one of these days. Don't draw blood unless it's absolutely necessary, I said, stepping out of my own torturous shoes. I'm going to try to make this quick and painless. If there's any rough stuff, not killing anyone will go a long way with the Svart Elves. Andy yawned at me. Ready? I asked. Andy bobbed her lupine head in a sharp, decisive nod. I drew the concealing magic of my top-of-the-line veil around us, and the light suddenly went dim, the colors leaching out of the world. We would be almost impossible to see, and anyone who came within 50 or 60 feet of us would develop a sudden desire for a bit of introspection, questioning their path in life so deeply that there was practically no chance we'd be detected as long as we were quiet. With Andy walking right beside me, we stole out into the hallway. We found the stairwell Waldo had told us about, and I opened the door to it slowly. I didn't go first. You can't do much better than having a werewolf as your guide, and I'd worked with Andy and her friends often enough in the past year to make our movements routine. Andy went through first, moving in total silence, her ears perked, her nose twitching. Wolves have incredible senses of smell, hearing too. If anyone was around, Andy would sense them. After a tense quarter of a minute, she gave me the signal that it was all clear by sitting down. I eased up next to her and extended my senses, feeling for any more magical defenses or enchantments. There were half a dozen on the first section of the stairwell. Simple things, the sorceress equivalent of trip wires. Fortunately, Auntie Leah had shown me how to circumvent enchantments such as these. I made an effort of will and modified our veil, and then I nodded to Andy, and we started slowly down the stairs. We slipped through the invisible fields of magic without disturbing them and crept down to the basement. I checked the door at the bottom of the stairs and found it unlocked. This seems way too easy, I muttered. If it's a prison, shouldn't this be locked? Andy let out a low growl, and I could sense her agreement and suspicion. My mouth still tingled, much more strongly now. Thomas was close.
Guess there's not a lot of choice here.
I opened the door, slowly and quietly. The door didn't open onto some kind of dungeon. It didn't open up to show us a vault, either. Instead, Andy and I found ourselves staring at a long hallway every bit as opulent as those above, with large and ornate doors spaced generously along it. Each door had a simple number on it, wrought in what looked like pure silver. Very subdued lighting was spaced strategically along its length, leaving it comfortably dim without being dark. Andy's low growl turned into a confused little sound, and she tilted her head to one side.
"Yeah," I said, perplexed. "It looks like a hotel. There's even a sign showing fire escape routes on the wall."
Andy gave her head a little shake, and I sensed enough of her emotions to understand her meaning. "What the hell?"
"I know," I said. "Is this living quarters for the Svartalfs? Guest accommodations?"
Andy glanced up at me and flicked her ears. "Why are you asking me? I can't even talk."
"I know you can't, just thinking out loud."
Andy blinked, her ears snapping toward me, and she gave me a sidelong glance.
"You heard me?"
"I didn't so much as hear you as just understand you."
She leaned very slightly away from me. "Just when I thought you couldn't get any more weird and disturbing."
I gave her a maliciously wide smile and the crazy eyes I used to use to scare my kid brothers and sisters. Andy snorted and then began testing the air with her nose. I watched her closely. Her hackles rose, and I saw her crouch down.
"There are things here. Too many scents to sort out. Something familiar, and not in a good way."
"Thomas is close. Come on." We started forward, and I kept my face turned directly toward the tingling signature of my tracking spell. It began to bear to the right, and as we got to the door to room 6, the tingle suddenly swung to the very corner of my mouth until I turned to face the doorway directly.
"Here, in 6.
Andy looked up and down the hall, her eyes restless, her ears trying to swivel in every direction.
"I don't like this." "Too easy," I whispered. "This is way too easy."
I reached out toward the doorknob and stopped. My head told me this situation was all wrong. So did my instincts. If Thomas was a prisoner being held by Svartalfheim, then where were the cages, the chains, the locks, the bars, the guards? And if he wasn't being held against his will, what was he doing here? When you find yourself in a situation that doesn't make any sense, it's usually for one reason. You have bad information. You can get bad information in several ways. Sometimes you're just plain wrong about what you learn. More often, and more dangerously, your information is bad because you made a faulty assumption. Worst of all is when someone deliberately feeds it to you, and, like a sucker, you trust her and take it without hesitation.
"Auntie," I breathed. "She tricked me."
Leah hadn't sent me into the building to rescue Thomas, or at least not only for that. It was no freaking coincidence that she'd taught me how to specifically circumvent the magical security the Svartalfs were using, either. She'd had another purpose in bringing me here on this night. I replayed our conversation in my mind and snarled. Nothing she told me was a lie, and all of it had been tailored to make me reach the wrong conclusion, that Thomas had to be rescued, and that I was the only one who would do it. I didn't know why the Lenanshi thought I needed to be where I was, but she sure as hell had made sure I would get there.
"That conniving, double-speaking, treacherous bitch! When I catch up with her, I'm going to..."
Andy let out a sudden, very low growl, and I shut up in the nick of time. The door from the upstairs opened, and that bastard Listen and several turtlenecks started walking down the hall toward us. Listen was a lean and fit-looking man of middling height. His hair was cropped military short, his skin was pale, and his dark eyes looked hard and intelligent. The werewolves and I had tried to bring him down half a dozen different times, but he always managed to either escape or turn the tables and make us run for our lives. Vicious bad guys are bad enough. Vicious, resourceful, ruthless, professional, smart bad guys are way worse. Listen was one of the latter,
and I hated his fishy guts. He and his lackeys were dressed in the standard uniform of the Fomor servitors. Black slacks, black shoes, and a black turtleneck sweater. The high neck of the sweater covered up the gills on both sides of their necks so that they could pass as mortals. They weren't, or at least they weren't anymore. The Fomor had changed them, making them stronger, faster, and all but immune to pain. I'd never managed to set up a successful ambush before, and now one had fallen right into my lap. I absolutely ached to avenge the blood I'd washed from my body early that very day. But the servitors had weird minds, and they kept getting weirder. It was damned difficult to get into their heads the way I would need to do, and if that first attack failed in close quarters like these, that crew would tear Andy and me apart. So I ground my teeth. I put my hand on Andy's neck and squeezed slightly as I crouched down beside her, focusing on the veil. I had to tamp down on the introspection suggestion. Listen had nearly killed me a few months before, when he noticed a similar enchantment altering the course of his thoughts. That had been damned scary, but I'd worked on it since then. I closed my eyes and spun the lightest, finest cobwebs of suggestion that my gifts could manage while simultaneously drawing the veil even tighter around us. The light in the hallway shrunk to almost nothing, and the air just over my skin became noticeably cooler. They came closer, Listen clearly in the lead, walking with swift and silent purpose. The son of a bitch passed within 2 feet of me. I could have reached out and touched him with my hand. None of them stopped. They went down the hall to room 8, and Listen pushed a key into a door. He opened it, and he and his buddies began to enter the room. This was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. For all the horror the Fomor had brought to the world since the extinction of the Red Court, we still didn't know why they did what they did. We didn't know what they wanted, or how they thought their current actions would get it for them. So I moved in all the silence the past year had taught me the hard way, and stalked up to the line of servitors passing into the chamber. After a startled second, Andy joined me just as quietly. We barely slipped through the door before it shut. No one looked back at us as we passed into a palatial suite, furnished as lavishly as the rest of the building. In addition to the half-dozen turtlenecks in Listen's party, another 5 were standing around the room in a guard position, back straight, their arms clasped behind them.
"Where is he?"
Listen asked a guard standing beside a door. The guard was the biggest turtleneck there, with a neck like a fireplug.
"Inside,"
the guard said.
"It is nearly time,"
Listen said.
"Inform him. He left orders that he was not to be disturbed."
Listen seemed to consider that for a moment. Then he said,
"A lack of punctuality will invalidate the treaty and make our mission impossible. Inform him."
The guard scowled.
"The Lord left orders that..."
Listen's upper body surged in a sudden motion, so fast that I could only see it as motion. The big guard let out a sudden hiss and a grunt, and blood abruptly fountained from his throat. He staggered a step, turned to Listen, and raised a hand. Then he shuddered and collapsed on the floor, blood pumping rapidly from a huge and jagged wound in his neck. Listen dropped a chunk of meat the size of a baseball from his bare, bloody fingers and bent over to wipe them clean on the dead turtleneck sweater. The blood didn't show against the black. He straightened up again, and then knocked on the door.
"My lord, it is nearly midnight."
He did it again exactly 60 seconds later, and he repeated it 3 more times before a slurred voice answered,
"I left orders that I was not to be disturbed. Forgive me, my lord, but the time is upon us. If we do not act, our efforts are for nothing. It is not for you to presume what orders may or may not be ignored,"
said the voice.
"Execute the fool who allowed my sleep to be disturbed. It is already done, my lord."
There was a somewhat mollified grunt from the far side of the door, and a moment later it opened, and for the first time I saw one of the lords of the Fomor. He was a tall, extremely gaunt being, yet somehow not thin. His hands and feet were too large, and his stomach bulged as if it contained a basketball. His jowls were oversized as well, his jaws swollen as if he had the mumps. His lips were too wide, too thick, and too rubbery-looking. His hair was too flattened, too limp, like strands of seaweed just washed up onto shore, and on the whole, he looked like some kind of gangling, poisonous frog. He was dressed only in a blanket draped around his shoulders. Ew. There were three women in the room behind him, naked and scattered and dead. Each had livid purple bruises around her throat and glassy, staring eyes. The turtlenecks all dropped to the floor in supplication as the Fomor entered, though Lysen only genuflected upon one knee.
"He is here?"
asked the Fomor.
"Yes, my lord,"
Lysen said,
"along with both of his bodyguards."
The Fomor croaked out a little laugh and rubbed his splay-fingered hands together.
"Mortal upstart, calling himself a baron. He will pay for what he did to my brother."
"Yes, my lord."
"No one is allowed to murder my family but me."
"Of course, my lord."
"Bring me the shell."
Lysen bowed and nodded to three of the other turtlenecks. They hurried to another door and then emerged, carrying between them an oyster shell that must have weighed half a ton. The thing was monstrous and covered in a crust of coral or barnacles or whatever those things are that grow on the hulls of ships. It was probably 7 feet across. The turtlenecks put it down on the floor in the middle of the room. The Fomor crossed to the shell, touched it with one hand, and murmured a word. Instantly, light blossomed all across its surface, curling and twisting in patterns, or maybe letters, I had never seen before. The Fomor stood over it for a time, one hand outstretched, bulbous eyes narrowed, saying something in a hissing, bubbling tongue. I didn't know what he was doing, but he was moving a lot of energy around, whatever it was. I could feel it filling the air of the chamber, making it seem tighter and somehow harder to breathe.
"My lord,"
asked Lysen abruptly,
"what are you doing?"
"Making a present for our new allies, of course,"
the Fomor said.
"I can hardly annihilate the Svartalfs along with everyone else. Not yet."
"This is not according to the plans of the Empress."
"The Empress,"
spat the Fomor,
"told me that I ought not harm our new allies. She said nothing of the puling scum attending their festivities."
"The Svartalfs value their honor dearly,"
Lysen said.
"You will shame them if their guests come to harm whilst under their hospitality, my lord. It could defeat the point of the alliance."
The Fomor spat. A glob of yellowy, mucus-like substance splattered the floor near Lysen's feet. It hissed and crackled against the marble floor.
"Once the treaty is signed, it is done. My gift will be given to them in the moments after. I will spare their miserable lives. And if the rest of the scum turn against the Svartalfs, they will have no choice but to turn to us for our strength."
He smirked.
"Fear not, Lysen. I am not so foolish as to destroy one of the Empress's special pets, even in an accident. You and your fellows will survive."
I suddenly recognized the tenor of energy building up in the giant shell on the floor, and my heart just about stopped. Holy crap. Lord Froggy had himself a bomb. Like, right there.
"My life belongs to my masters, to spend as they will, my lord,"
Lysen said.
"Have you any other instruction?"
"Seize whatever treasure you might from the dead before we depart."
Lysen bowed his head.
"How efficacious do you anticipate your gift to be?"
"The one I made for the Red Court in the Congo was deadly enough,"
Lord Froggy said, a smug tone in his voice. My heart pounded even harder. During its war with the White Council, the Red Court had used some kind of nerve gas on a hospital tending wounded wizards. The weapon had killed tens of thousands of people in a city far smaller and less crowded than Chicago. My bare feet felt tiny and cold.
Lord Froggy grunted and fluttered his fingers, and the bombshell vanished, hidden by a veil as good as anything I could do. The Fomor Lord abruptly lowered his hand, smiling.
Bring my robes.
The turtlenecks hurriedly dressed Lord Froggy in what